231-8032 to express your opinion, or email program@kboo.org. You can continue to hear Democracy Now! On KBOO each morning at 7 a.m.
KBOO's fall membership drive starts on the 10th, and you could help make reaching our fundraising goal a little easier by offering a matching donation of at least $500 for us to use on air during the drive. Matching money is a really great motivator to entice our non-contributing listeners to donate. So please email membership@kboo.org if you would like to sign up or have any questions. Or just call 503-231-8032 and ask for the membership department to plan your fall drive matching gift today.
Dada, dada, dada day. Thursday, Thursday. Come one, come all to the Clinton Street Theater this Thursday for an evening of Dada film and music. We'll be playing surrealist silent films and cartoons, and the soundtrack will be provided by you, the audience. So bring your favorite musical instrument, kitchen implement, speak and spell, tantric bell, hotkeys, or tchotchkes to the Clinton Street Theater, Southeast Clinton and 26th Avenue in Portland, this Thursday, October 10th at 7 p.m. Tickets available at brownpapertickets.com. All proceeds benefit your community radio station, KBOO. Thursday, Dada, Clinton Street, KBOO. At least the Haggis arrived at a reasonable hour.
I'd love to wander back.
Hi there. This is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
This is KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 11:02 a.m. Coming up on Health Watch, host David Naiman interviews the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar, and Autism Spectrum. And at 11:30 on Madness Radio, host Will Hall speaks with Deborah Marshall, psychiatric survivor and human rights activist, about the controversial borderline personality disorder diagnosis and new developments in the international human rights movement of users and survivors of psychiatry. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support, and thanks for listening to your community radio station. Stay tuned.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. There has been a 41% increase in the diagnosis of ADHD over the past decade, a 40-fold spike in childhood bipolar diagnosis, and autism spectrum disorders, once considered rare, have increased by 78%. Today's guest, clinical psychologist Dr. Enrico Naolati, has witnessed firsthand the increase in the diagnosis of these disorders in children and is here today on Health Watch to talk about why he believes children are being overdiagnosed and how parents and professionals can distinguish between true psychiatric disorders and normal childhood reactions to stressful life situations. His new book is Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. Welcome to Health Watch, Dr. Enrico Naolati.
Good morning, David. Thanks for having me.
So how do we know that this enormous increase in the last decade of these diagnoses is actually overdiagnosis and not more screening and more attention to discovering these conditions in children?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, there's the easy answer would be, believe it or not, that most children shed these diagnoses by the time they're up into their mid-20s. So for instance, with a diagnosis like ADHD, there's a study out of NIMH showing that you know, 75% or more of kids with that are giving these diagnoses by the time they're in their mid-20s no longer fit the criteria. You know, bipolar disorder, upwards of 35% of kids diagnosed with the disorder no longer fit the criteria by their mid-20s. And if you look at, like, autism spectrum disorder, a couple of studies I look at in my book, anywhere between about 30 to 40% of children that are ascribed that diagnosis at some point in their childhood no longer fit the criteria. So what I take that to mean is that many, 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 if not most children shed these diagnoses, which are supposed to be, at least for a veteran psychologist like myself, severe, debilitating, lifelong conditions that don't all of a sudden, you know, stop applying.
And do you think that some of this misdiagnosis early on is due to doctors not taking enough time to do a proper diagnosis, or do you think it is changing definition of the diseases themselves, or even pressure from the pharmaceutical companies to widen their audiences?
All of the above, David. I mean, I the average length of a pediatric visit these days is 16 minutes, and pediatricians are doing the most prescribing of medications. So, and you know, for psychiatrists these days, in the vernacular, there's the 15-minute med check. So what you're seeing, I would argue, is a shrinkage of time that at least these mental health professionals are spending with children and families, such that there's a tremendous pressure to, like, really speak in shorthand about a child, to really cut to the chase, keep the discussion symptom focused, and in our larger culture these days, we seem to be more comfortable, you know, speaking with quasi symptom language, is distractible, an ADHD moment, impulsive, forgetful. So much so that in the doctor's office, the average parent is more comfortable than they should be having a curtailed, shorthand, symptom focused discussion with their doctor that then, you know, can railroad a child into getting a diagnosis fairly rapidly, rather than sit back and having a long, drawn-out discussion about their child and how they behave across contexts, home, school, you know, so much so that we get a really full picture on a child. Actually, one last thought there. There's studies that show that with ADHD, where you're required to show that a child is symptomatic across two environments. Therefore, you should, you know, with questionnaire, behavior checklist type questionnaires that need to be filled out to substantiate that. There are studies that show that the majority of children, there's only one questionnaire that's filled out either by a teacher or a parent, so much so that if you keep to the two questionnaire standard, about 40% of kids, one study that I look at in my book, about 40% of kids then no longer fit the criteria for ADHD. If you just simply do what's expected, in other words, have, you know, a parent as well as a teacher, or maybe three teachers fill out a questionnaire in addition to a minister or a tutor or an uncle or someone, you know, a variety of people who know the child well. So even if you stick to that, that's one reason I would say for the overdiagnosis of ADHD in particular.
One of the interesting parts in your ADHD section, Dr. Nalati, was the study that looked at the age of children in kindergarten, and that there's the possibility that up to 1 million children in kindergarten are misdiagnosed with ADHD simply because they are one of the younger students in the class and thus more immature and being expected to do things that are only having to do with the bureaucracy of what grade you're assigned to based on a specific date cutoff.
Yeah, you know, absurd but tragic, I think, finding. Yeah, I mean, Todd Elder at Michigan State University, who's an economist, actually, ran some statistics and showed fairly convincingly that probably upwards of 1 million kindergartens in our country are misdiagnosed or falsely diagnosed as ADHD simply because they're either the younger or more immature kid in the classroom. And he estimates that probably something in the region of about, we're wasting about $500 million a year on unnecessary treatment for these kids, not to mention, you know, the harm that can come into play when a child is ascribed a false diagnosis.
We're talking today with Dr. Enrico Naulati, the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. So what are some of the tips that you have to help people distinguish normal childhood behavior that may seem similar to ADHD from the actual psychiatric condition?
Therein lies the rub, David, and in my book I really break it down but believe it or not, I think in order to tease apart what is a true evidence of a true diagnosis or a valid diagnosis, and evidence of other things, and I'll talk about this in a minute here about ordinary childhood narcissism, really requires that the professional doing the assessment be solidly aware of what's normal. How does a child behave under transitory stress? What does a slow to mature child look like rather than a disordered child? What is evidence of just a difficult personality trait, but that is just part of normal human variation versus a disorder, or at least a mild case of a disorder? So, for instance, what I would argue is that because we've loosened up the criteria for these disorders, made them spectrum disorders, included mild cases, now we get into that situation where there's a lot of confusion if you ask me about what is evidence of a true disorder versus these other things. But if you look at something like ADHD, and I've been doing this for years, and it's stunning to me the parallels between what on the surface appear like ADHD symptoms and garden variety childhood narcissism. So, for instance, one aspect of just normal narcissism in childhood is a child having what I call overconfident expectations. So, in other words, a child who believes that they're highly capable of succeeding, that they should be able to kind of just master tasks without a great deal of effort or perseverance, that they expect to know things without having to learn them. I think this applies to most children most of the time, and I would say it's part of just normal childhood narcissism. That can start to look like an ADHD symptom, where a child then doesn't prepare, doesn't plan, doesn't practice, doesn't study, and therefore does poorly at school, just as a function of just their having overconfident expectations, not necessarily because they have ADHD. Or something like forgetfulness could be simply a child. Forgetfulness is one of the symptoms of ADHD, but it could be simply a child who's under-practiced, under-memorized, because they feel like they should just be able to automatically know things. Because that magical thinking applies. And I think that's an aspect of normal childhood narcissism that can get confounded with ADHD.
And you also talk about a big gender discrepancy in terms of the way boys and girls behave and are expected to behave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I make the controversial point, and I hope I make it delicately and effectively, that I think that in our country right now that we define normal in terms of how the average girl behaves, but not the average boy. And getting back to that kindergarten study, it's well known in social science research that boys are behind girls during those kindergarten years a full year in basic self-regulation skills. So that just means sitting without a wiggly body, raising your hand and waiting to be called on, not blurting out answers, just basic self-control, self-regulation. Girls in those early kindergarten years are about a year ahead of boys. The same applies to fine motor skills. And so the more we expect of kindergartners to be able to write, for instance, and write legibly or draw shapes legibly, we're placing a standard that maybe comes a little easier to the average girl, not the average boy, that then makes them look like they have some kind of deficit. And I could go on. I mean, there's also boys' traditional masculine communication habits. I think the average boy tends to be businesslike, serious, engage in long-winded monologues, grandstand, what's called be more egoistic in their communication patterns, less likely to read other kids' faces to get feedback of whether or not they're talking on and on too much. And so that aspect of traditional masculinity, if you don't really honor it, in some cases can look like just a mild case of autism if there's other things going on. And then when it comes to aggression, I think that we really miss the boat in terms of understanding the degree to which aggression in boys is just a like rough and tumble play as a core, I would say, evolutionary-based dimension of social bonding between boys. So the more we disallow preschoolers and young children to just rough it up and redirect them, and not allow them to engage in kind of aggressive rough and tumble play, the more we deprive them of what I would consider natural outlets for their aggression to build expressive mastery of their aggression, and that can do funny things to a child's behavior, a boy's behavior.
And I'm presuming that you think that the higher increase in diagnosis of these conditions in boys is partly related to this.
Definitely, yeah, and the statistics are borne out. So, for instance, right now in the latest studies out of the Centers for Disease Control show that about 1 in 54 boys is being diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. That's about 5 times the rate of girls. ADHD is diagnosed about 3 times the rate in boys as it is in girls. First and second grade boys are 3 times more likely to be medicated. 75% of students labeled emotionally disturbed and referred to special education are males. So I argue in my book that we really are abnormalizing boys in our country, and we definitely have to do a better job of having gender discussions about what's normal, what's expectable. And I also make the controversial point in my book, too, that most of the professions where children come under the scrutiny, their behavior comes under scrutiny, pediatrics, the teaching profession, the mental health profession, are heavily tilted in the direction of there being females who are in that professional role. And it may be, and it's a controversial point that I'm making, that, you know, a female teacher, for instance, is likely to have a gendered position in terms of, like, what is normal and expectable in a child. I know it's a controversial point, but I think we have to start addressing these issues at a public level to turn the tide of boys and traditional masculine behavior getting abnormalized.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Health Watch on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host, and we're talking today to Enrico Nalati, the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. Dr. Nalati, you mentioned autism and mild cases of autism maybe being misdiagnosed in boys who are exhibiting normal boy behavior. We had Temple Grandin on talking about autism previously, and she talked about the vital importance of getting an early diagnosis for good outcomes. And I know in your book, you talk about the dangers for all of these conditions of too early a diagnosis, both because of the potential of a misdiagnosis and also because of the potential stigma or over-medication. So how do you parse that out when it's possible that someone who truly has the disorder getting diagnosed earlier, they're going to get the help they need, but someone who doesn't have the disorder but may have something close to it is going to get misdiagnosed?
Once again, it's a great question, and it's a thorny question, and I do believe that early detection, early screening and detection of autism is extremely important, and it ought to be the public health imperative that it is. But that said, I would argue when it comes to the mild cases, you know, the younger in age that we screen and detect autism, the more likely that a struggling child, a struggling toddler in particular, will be misconstrued as having a mild case of autism spectrum disorder. And I can kind of, if you want, speak to that issue some more.
Well, it's interesting, the statistic that you give in Back to Normal, that up to 30% of children diagnosed with autism at age 2 do no longer fit the diagnosis at age 4.
Yes, it's out of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And so that's a pretty remarkable misdiagnosis rate.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I think there are people that would say that perhaps, you know, so the 30% number should take into consideration children that had a mild case of it and got the services they need and fell off the spectrum. My point, and it's a conservative point, though, is that I do believe that autism spectrum disorder is a severe, debilitating, lifelong condition where you don't move in and out of it. So that would be my counterpoint. And so there's that. But the 30% number, I think, you know, has to point to just cases where the diagnosis doesn't apply in the first place, or large numbers of them.
Well, let me ask you a question about childhood bipolar disorder. I know that not long ago, it wasn't considered a disorder that happened very frequently or nearly at all, and now we're seeing quite a bit of childhood bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. Do you think any part of the rise in that condition is due to the rise in the use of ADHD medications? Because I know there is a small percentage of people who will have manic episodes or psychosis when they're on the ADHD meds.
You know, I can't speak to that question with, you know, great knowledge. I mean, I do know, though, that one of the least discussed side effects to the ADHD medication are negative mood states when a child is coming off of their morning doze. So I do think there is a medication-related explosive temper, negative mood reaction situation on ADHD meds with some kids that can start to look like a bipolar ridge. So, yeah.
And there's also some controversy in the medical community about the definition of childhood bipolar.
Yeah, and therein lies the rub once again. Bipolar disorder about a decade ago was rewritten, whereby mania in children was defined as irritability, rather than classic mania, and that just opened the floodgates, I think, in terms of seeing children who have explosive episodes as having bipolar disorder and that being a form of mania. And I think that's one of the factors for the spike in diagnoses of bipolar disorder in kids and teens. The other one is what's called psychiatric rebranding. So in other words, in the 70s and 80s, there were diagnoses that were popular, like oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorder, that were perfectly good diagnoses for people like me to ascribe to a kid that weren't, on the face of it, severe diagnoses, but got the kid the help and the treatment they needed. With managed care and the rationing of mental health care, those types of diagnoses no longer got the kid the kind of coverage they needed. And so all of a sudden we start to see bipolar entering the picture, which is, you know, generally considered a severe and debilitating mental illness, and that got kids the coverage that they needed. So we rebranded diagnoses you know, in ways that whereby bipolar disorder became the preferred diagnosis to use to make sure a kid that was, you know, argumentative, irritable, explosive got the help he or she needed.
So, Dr. Nalati, we only have a couple minutes, but maybe you could just touch on some of the solutions you offer and back to normal, or the tips that you point people to in terms of solutions.
Well, it's complicated. I have a whole chapter in the back called Parenting with Authority. Let me end with a few words of wisdom for parents. I mean, I think we always need to remind ourselves as parents that most children, most of the time, are naturally impulsive, forgetful, distractible, moody, disorganized, prone to take the easy way out, and their self-discipline is a perpetual work in progress. And so we really need to start there and not assume that a child has something diagnosable going on just because they're not born with the ability to engage in self-control and, you know, to kind of self-monitor their moods. And parents should also realize that most of the time under their roof, they're probably seeing their child at their worst. So in other words, in this day and age, most kids inhibit themselves at school to fit in because of all the demands that are out there. And at home, that's where they show their inner monster, their more primitive, regressed self. Because most kids, I think, at home believe they'll always be loved no matter what. And so it's much riskier to kind of act out at school than it is at home. So then that late afternoon homework situation is the classic one where a child starts behaving like they're certifiably insane when they're just simply asked to sit down and do their homework. So parents should be wary about assuming that the child that they see under their roof acting insanely can be generally true of their child. So I would say keep those things in mind. Try as much as possible to strive for calm assertiveness. If you're getting triggered over and over by your child in the same ways, engage in some self-examination to see what might be getting recreated from your own childhood in unhelpful ways. At times, challenge the intensity of your child's feelings, but not necessarily the legitimacy of them. Most of what children need to be socialized as to the outward expression of emotion. They may have legitimate reasons for being angry or sad or irritated, but the way they express it might be over the top. Children need help with word choices. They need help with defining what's an appropriate way to express anger. They're not born with that. So in your parental role, see yourself as needing to socialize your child as to what's appropriate, you know, expressive mastery, what's appropriate in the way of expressing emotion. So I'll leave your listeners with some of those tips.
That was great, Dr. Nalati. It was a pleasure having you on Health Watch today.
I really enjoy having the opportunity.
We're talking today with Dr. Enrico Nalati, the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine. Next up is Madness Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor two talks by Nicole Foss. Wednesday, October 9th, at 7 p.m., she'll speak at the First Congregational Church in Corvallis, 4515 Southwest West Hills Road. And Thursday, October 10th, at 7 p.m., she'll be at Tabor Space on Southeast 55th and Belmont in Portland. Nicole Foss, writer and editor for theautomaticearth.org, is a big picture thinker and tours the world talking about environmental degradation and how we, as a community, can prepare ourselves and our neighbors for these realities. Nicole devotes a big chunk of her talks to practical suggestions for changes that people can make right now. That's Nicole Foss speaking October 9th at the First Congregational Church in Corvallis and October 10th at Tabor Space in Portland. More information can be found on the right-hand side of kbu.fm under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Deborah Marshall, and Deborah is a psychiatric survivor and human rights activist.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the show, Deborah. And so you've been really an important figure in the European human rights movement around psychiatry and working with psychiatric survivor issues since 2008. Is that right?
Being part of the activist movement has been really important to me personally.
So I'd like to speak more about your work with human rights organizing internationally, but tell us about your own involvement with the psychiatric system. And your family has a history of being psychiatric patients in hospitals. Is that right?
My family are survivors of the Holocaust in Europe who came to Australia. And psychiatry, I think, was the way that distress and crisis and all of these feelings that couldn't be spoken about in relation to the Holocaust and trauma were processed in Australia. So I think my grandfather and different people in my family ended up in the system on the receiving end of the system, but they didn't necessarily speak about it. It was something that was taboo and